let's say you had a curiosity about, maybe even a hankering for, Indiana's signature dessert, sugar cream pie. You might search for it, and on a typical foodie website, find this description, written in typical foodie prose. As Indiana's state pie, this rich, nutmeg-dusted custard pie also goes by the name Hoosier Pie. Born from Amish and Shaker communities that settled in Indiana in the 1800s, this quote-unquote desperation pie, a category that refers to pies made when fresh fruit wasn't available or money was short, is as simple as it is delicious. Now, sugar cream pie may be delicious, but there's nothing delicious, nothing delectable in that description. Compare that to the one Matthew Gavin Frank offers in his new book, The Mad Feast, An Ecstatic Tour Through America's Food. Our Hoosier cream pie is so soft we can cut it with our pinkies. So sweet we can think only of how it moves us, speeds our hearts, allows us to run from towns called Amboy and Ammo, Trafalgar and Troy. Running, we can think of all our dead aunts and uncles, all of the filled-in quarries, their ceilings waiting to collapse. The kinds of state histories buried beneath rock and dust and tablespoons of sugar we allow to burn, harden, lacquer the tops of our Hoosier cream pies. Frank's description is no historical tidbit or bland factoid. It's something more like a tribute, though only if a tribute can embrace the sadness of what it celebrates, the troubled soul beneath its shining surface. And, like the rest of Frank's book, it's wonderfully written. Here is a food writer who cares as much about the words on the page as the food in our mouths. And the rest of Frank's attention And the result of Frank's attention to both is a book that gives us a fresh look at America and its food. Frank takes up 50 signature dishes from 50 states in 50 essays, each as surprising and engaging as a dish cooked up by a half-crazed, half-genius chef who's determined that the best tastes make the familiar strange, but no less enticing. Matt Frank, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you today. You've got this new book, Mad Feast, An Ecstatic Tour Through America's Food. And it is mad and ecstatic and crazy to read and wildly interesting. And so the obvious question to me is, where did this cookbook come from? Well, cookbook, travel writing, food writing, personal essay, imaginative flight of fancy. I mean, it's got it all in there. So it's an unusual book, and I definitely want to get to it, but you are an unusual writer. You don't come down the kind of traditional track of, you know, I went to Oxford and Princeton, and then I somehow wound up making immortal literature. You've got a really kind of funky background. What is that all about? Where does this book come from? Tell us a little bit about its origins before we get to it.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for saying all of those nice things. And secondly, thank you for that awesome British accent. that was great. I spent most of my occupational life in restaurant kitchens. I started at age 11 washing dishes in a fast food chicken shack on the outskirts of Chicago. It was this place called the Broastery, which you remember, I'm sure, that kind of broasted chicken craze in the mid-80s. It was supposed to be this healthier alternative to fried chicken, which is completely false. It's deep fried chicken, essentially just in a lot more oil. So it's kind of like half pressure cooked, half deep fried. I graduated to my, role as a broaster, too, which I guess it's just an unfortunate word to lend to food, broasted, to broast. It sounds so unappetizing. But I remember when I became a broaster and stopped washing dishes there. I was compelled by my boss, this really dyspeptic and megalomaniacal guy named Ira, to shake these kind of frying baskets up and down while they were in the oil. I think this was in the early stage of broasting chicken. The technique was, and the philosophy behind it was kind of ill-formed, and it remained that way, frankly. But I think Ira thought that if we shook these baskets up and down in the oil would somehow miraculously not kind of embed itself into the chicken and breading itself, but miraculously fly off. And then, the resulting fried chicken would thereby somewhat, somehow be healthier. It wasn't, of course. And we fry cooks just got scarred up as a result. I think my oil scars on my forearms faded only just last year. But I don't know, man. I guess I've just been thinking about food and working with food and manipulating it and touching it and interrogating it, and in part, like in the broastery, sacrificing my body to it for so many years. It just, I don't know, is sort of this default obsession of mine. And I eventually, just started writing about it. And in the book, in The Mad Feast, I really just wanted to start interrogating these seemingly mundane dishes as associated with each of our 50 U.S. states, just kind of scratching at them and scratching at them and scratching at them until some kind of inner holiness or horror began to leak out. And that holiness and horror usually kind of trickled its way up along some kind of shadowy back alleys of regional U.S. history. And I kind of embedded my discussions of these dishes into those shadowy back alleys, I guess in some kind of attempt, however hazy, to comment on why we eat, what we eat, where we eat it.
There's a sort of deep love that only a love that is mixed with abhorrence that's fueling the book. And I want to go back to that. You call it a spastic, lyrical, anti-cookbook cookbook, right? Yeah. That's kind of the phrase. Could you unpack that a little bit for us? Because you get this sense, in a cookbook, you're expecting this kind of lavish sense of food writing and celebration. So to call it an anti-cookbook cookbook right there, the reader might be like, what am I getting myself into?
Yeah, which is why the book has a preface. My editor was really worried about that, too, frankly, that folks would open up the book if there was no kind of, preface as disclaimer in the beginning, and just, basically say, like, where am I and what is this? And so reluctantly, I wrote that preface. I kind of, I'm all about being disoriented when I open up a book, and I'm all about just kind of arguing with a text and then conversing with it and all of this, and just kind of grappling my way towards some kind of understanding of it. But I understand how that might be off-putting too, and so the preface found its way in there. The cookbook part of spastic, lyrical, anti-cookbook cookbook is there because there are 50 recipes in the book, one for each essay, one for each of the 50 U.S. states, as contributed by a chef working in a restaurant in the corresponding states. The I'm moving backwards with this unpacking, I guess. The anti-cookbook portion, this is how linear I am. I'm starting with the last thing. I'm going from cookbook to anti-cookbook. But the anti-cookbook portion of it is, I've long found that a lot of the text that accompanies recipes in our cookbooks, typically, I mean, not exclusively, but typically, however brief these portions of text are terribly uninspiring and rote, and they're not necessarily offering us any new point of entry, not only into the dish itself, but the dish's history and, you know, however beautiful or atrocious that history is. And I just felt these dishes that I at least, you know, was engaging in this book were ripe for interrogation. They're dishes we oftentimes take for granted. We see them on the menu and you know, kind of leash very little thought to them, I guess. And I wanted the text of these essays to kind of undo some of that complacency with which we greet food we only claim, I guess, in other cookbooks to celebrate or you know, use as a point of connection with kind of our childhoods or with various other memories or with family members. And I felt like there was more to the story than that. And so I felt like the corresponding essays kind of interrogated the parameters of the cookbook and of food writing and basically asked what could it do, what should it do that it isn't doing. Why I asked myself, why do I find 95% of the food writing that I read so terribly uninspiring and just kind of flogging a dead horse and not necessarily saying anything new. And I asked, why do I feel that way? And why am I still so obsessed with food and still so compelled to write about it? And how can I bring something new to it? And I guess that's where the anti-cookbook part comes in. And the spastic lyrical stuff, as I'm guessing you can get from my kind of meandering answers, sort of points to the style toward which I naturally gravitate. I'm naturally digressive, and rather than, I guess, sweep some of these digressions as they kind of, you know, leash themselves up to meditations on food and state history under the essayistic carpet, I decided to inflame them and talk about them and, manipulate connections between some of these digressive threads, state history, and the food to see how each would converse with the other and how that conversation would maybe grapple, or compel us, I guess, toward the illusion of a larger understanding about, as I mentioned, why we eat, what we eat, where we eat it in this country.
Yeah, I think that if I could maybe crisscross back over some of what you said to give listeners a better sense of the book is sumptuously produced. It's really a beautiful hardback, a gorgeous cover. You open it up and it seems as though it's going to be the kind of height of the logician's kitchen. There's 50 chapters, one for each state. There's a food that is featured in each chapter. So far you're thinking, oh, well, this is kind of the straightforward layout of one of those interesting cookbooks that you could give grandma for the holidays. And then you start to look at one of the given tables of contents, and you've broken it up into regions. And so you see, oh, well, it's even broken down into different regional areas, you know, and then you think like Uncle John, oh, he has an interest in America. I'll get this for him. And then as you start to get to the subtitles, you see what you're going to get into. And if I could just read, here's what's going on in the Mountain West. You have Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, and Colorado. But here are the actual titles that you give us. The Desperate Deranging of Milk Can Supper. Prayer for the Spudnuts as they take to the sky, the circumventing of the elk stew at altitude with the Denver omelet. I mean, suddenly this fun starts to infuse it. And I think that's one of the things I would want to highlight for listeners. When I was trying to get at the mix of emotion that's going on in the piece, I think what you see is a love of the fool food. I mean, even as you were describing broasting, you could tell that you had an affection for this odd thing that was coming out of it. And each of these foods, you're not afraid to turn it over and look at it from all its dimensionality and see what's going on inside of it. And it makes for a really rich reading experience.
Thanks so much, Eric. Yeah, I've always been interested in the ways in which indictment dovetails with affection. And so I have a love for all of these foods, and but of course, if you love something completely and obsessively, you don't love it in a one dimensional way, and so you want to love the food for its imperfections, and occasionally even though you don't love a lot of the history response. For the food appearing on our plate in its current incarnation today, you want to love the food for the fact that it's passed through the lens of some kind of atrocious historical events in our country in order to get to us. And I think if we eat these dishes, or if I inspire readers to eat these dishes with heavier hearts, that's something that I've committed out of love. So certainly I had so much fun writing this book, and I think that kind of bleeds through too. So
oh yeah, there's not a sentence I think that isn't energetic in the entire thing. Picking up on what you said, when you crack open the cookbooks that you find on the browsing tables back when there were bookstores, but the ones that still show up online and things like that, or the photographs that go with them, they're like foods without history that have been airbrushed into perfection. And the foods that you give us, they have carried their scars and crimes through the maelstrom of history to show up on the plate. And so you're eating something that is rich and full and mixed and shot through with American culture, which is a lot different than kind of bringing out the supermodel version of key lime pie and saying, isn't it gorgeous? Doesn't it, photograph so well?
I mean, the things and the people with which and with whom we are most intimate, are folks we occasionally ridicule, are folks we occasionally indict, and folks with whom we argue and interrogate, even though we love them so completely, we love them so much, we free ourselves to indict and ridicule every so often. And this is going to sound completely hokey, but I view each of these dishes and their stories as members of my family every so often. As I was writing these essays, loving them even while kind of pushing them away and being revolted. And then, I get to another bit of information, and then I just want to take them close into my chest again and whisper sweet nothings into their ears and calm them down. And and I'm talking about maybe family members and food dishes as I'm saying that. So, yeah.
Well, I wonder if you'd be willing to read us a sample of it so that listeners can get some sense of, what they'd be getting into.
Sure. Yeah, I could read a really short segment. I live in Michigan right now, and I am presently, embedded within the state of Michigan, I feel like I can't read the Michigan essay. It just feels too intimate. I feel like the trees will have some sort of conniption fit out the window or something. But I do want to read something close to Michigan. So I'll read the first two segments of the Minnesota essay. And the dish that I chose for Minnesota is the hot dish. I think a lot of upper Midwesterners know what hot dish is, but for folks who don't, hot dish is essentially a catch-all casserole birthed in desperation. and there's usually, something crunchy on the top. It's like all of this amalgam of soft stuff and stewed stuff, meat, vegetables, potatoes, cream of mushroom soup, and so on. And then there's usually kind of a crunchy topping. I guess without further ado, I'll just get into it, because I talk about some of that stuff in the essay. The title is "The Hot Dish Muddies the Water, or those poor drowned. This is desperation, imagination, blowing bubbles into our cream of mushroom soup, not because we're feeling playful, but because in this cold, the snow fine as dust, it hurts to take air in. So we extend our exhales as long as we can, pretend that history and nostalgia are the same thing. This has everything to do with a tater tot crust as blanket in our hot dish, as some golden brown storm cloud cresting the baking pan, yanked from failing oven after failing oven in the church basements of Arrowhead, along the shores of Lake Superior, in International Falls, Minneapolis, St. Paul. This winter has depth, layers. This is winter as casserole, as the French word for saucepan. This is a season so freezing, it doubles back on itself and simmers. Sometimes our bodies get so cold, they burn. Sometimes we overflow the pan's lip, stiffen on the element. Sometimes, like the drowned with ice in their lungs, we stick to the bottom. In this weather, unlike the tater tots in our hot dish, we don't golden, but redden. Uncle talks of his years harvesting sugar beets, raising turkeys in Todd County, now the poorest goddamn county in the state, he says, before he was forced by General Mills, Cargill, Hormel, and Schwann to retire. These same companies now producing the processed hamburger and frozen string beans and potato buds we heap into our hot dish, used to feed congregations. He lost so much of his body to the cold and to the thresher, he has a single finger left. The important one, he says, as he struggles to wrap it like a boa over the stem of his fork, sink it into the hottest middle part beneath the tater tots. According to Hallie Herron's article, Heating Up the Heartland, Minnesota's signature hot dish combines heartiness, great taste, and adaptability. Our state casserole retains no official recipe or rules beyond economic and gustatory desperation. As such, we have our hamburger, mashed potato, string bean, cream of mushroom soup, La Choy fried onion hot dish, and our hot dish made with canned tuna and Kraft macaroni and cheese, with canned peas or canned corn, topped with potato chips crushed to dust, or shoestring potatoes, or anything crunchy and sharp enough to remind us that we still have some fight left, even in all of this cold, that we're not all, just mostly, soft. Herron says hot dish was birthed out of hardship when, quote, budget-minded farm wives needed to feed their own families as well as congregations in the basements of the first Minnesota churches. And she says that the cream of mushroom soup soon became so favored, so ubiquitous, that it became better known in early hot dish circles as Lutheran binder. And I guess I'll leave it there, Eric.
That's great. I grew up eating that dish.
I grew up on the outskirts of Chicago again, but I grew up eating a variation or many variations of hot dish, all of which were unfortunately microwaved.
Well, so Uncle shows up in that piece, and yeah. Uncle is someone that shows up throughout the book, as well as aunt and wife makes an appearance and things like that. But they're not necessarily the uncle that a reader might expect on first encountering him.
Yeah, he definitely, the uncle is a device in the book. He is very much the He is very much my antagonist, I suppose. He essentially, the introduction of the uncle as character, and this uncle character persists throughout all 50 essays. And of course, I did not grow up in all 50 states. I think that's obviously clear. And so the uncle is one part my uncle, and then, you know, say 50 parts other people's uncles. He is very much a composite character. A lot of the stuff that he says in the book is culled from interviews that I conducted with folks in the states at hand, whether there were folks working for museums or historical societies or restaurant kitchens, or none of those, just folks I happened to encounter through kind of a serpentine path and my kind of meandering research process. And so he's somebody with whom I can argue right there on the page. But he is real in the sense that he's a little bit of a lot of very real people. Or little bits of a lot of very real people. I found Eric as I, was researching, and conducting interviews, both online and over the phone and then eventually in person. I did visit all 50 states, in twitchy fashion, as I was putting this book together, in order to kind of immerse myself in what the filmmaker Werner Herzog sometimes calls the voodoo of location, and then conduct on-site interviews too. But I found that a lot of the narratives that attend not only state histories, kind of the evolution and kind of origins of these particular dishes are myriad, and oftentimes they conflict with each other. And so the uncle character was a way to kind of embody that conflict and these diverse narratives right there on the page. So I'll find some Iowa historian who claims that the loose meat sandwich, which is Iowa's state dish, it's kind of like a sloppy Joe without the sauce, that the loose meat sandwich originated in this one particular way, but a lot of the folks in Iowa have different stories, and they've heard of these different origin stories, and so the uncle essentially argues not only with me as persona in these essays, but argues with some of the research right there on the page too, in order to better establish just how complex our narratives are in this country. And then if we conflate that, how complex our identities are, both within each state and as a country entire.
Yeah, I think that as I was reading the book, he came to be something like the dark, contrary, hunkering doppelganger of Uncle Sam, like, you know, the brother that was never acknowledged.
He's so curmudgeonly, but he's endured such tragedy too, and so a lot of his just kind of the curmudgeonliness is birthed out of hardship and tragedy, as it oftentimes is here in our crazy cockeyed United States of America.
When you're eating with one finger, that's how it turns out to be. So readers might not have expected to encounter Uncle, but they will be glad that they did. I can imagine also readers coming to the book might not have imagined, even though it's called Essays, even though essay accommodates digression and exploration and quotation and flights of fancy, to see entire chapters written as a Google search or as endnotes or parentheses or organized by dates. Can you tell us a little bit about the ways in which you're working with form in this piece?
Sure. Let's not forget about the Arkansas essay, which is basically narrated by an ever reincarnating beaver. the dish is beaver tail stew, which I ate a few times in Arkansas. some of the beaver tail stews were delicious. Some of them were a little bit challenging. The beaver tail, even though it's kind of seen in certain rural areas of Arkansas as this luxury cut, it can be cartilaginous if not sufficiently stewed. So anyway, I could talk about that one too. The ever reincarnating beaver was a way to not only deal with what it takes to trap a beaver and excise its tail and cook it and eat it, and what sort of other sociocultural flights of fancy as they attend the state of Arkansas might also attend that meditation, but also just to kind of meander through history with this animal that is always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And that shoe is, it is going to be killed for its tail. And so we kind of move through that essay as narrated by the beaver, but we also, are privy to kind of meditations on Aquinas and Lewis and Clark. Clark's explorations and time that they spent in Arkansas, all the way up through the Clinton era in Arkansas, and what they had to do with the beaver also. And so, the beaver was just, as narrator, I suppose, was a way to just kind of move from Lewis and Clark to Hillary and Bill in an effort to kind of just trace Arkansas's history in kind of a weird, interesting way. I'm always, Eric, one of my steps when I'm going through the process of writing an essay is to, I'm really interested in testing an essay's parameters, not just what food writing can do and what the cookbook can do, but what the essay can do, to see how much manipulation, to see how many flights of fancy, to see how much crazy juxtaposition and digression an essay can take before it breaks. It's kind of like overlaying those onion skins down atop those architectural blueprints. You know, you begin with that kind of bare bones blueprint, and then you lay one onion skin atop another, atop another, atop another. And if you lay on the perfect amount of onion skins, you could kind of see the finished building and envision it. If you lay on a few too many onion skins, the building collapses. But during the process, I'm always interested in the point at which the essay collapses. And then, of course, I dial back and comb out and revise. But I want to see what it can take. And so I oftentimes shoehorn an essay into a particular form, whether that is in the form of a Google search or writing in the form of endnotes, or, you know, shoehorning it into the form of note cards or the Harvard outline or a syllabus, and so on and so forth. I mean, the choices are seemingly endless, just to see what that would do, how that form would girdle the essay and make the essay uncomfortable in certain ways, where certain portions of it would stick out like sore thumbs and other portions of it would conform beautifully to that form. Oftentimes I won't leave the essay in that form. I just want to see what that form would do to it. And I could always take it out of that form, but rarely, after being kind of manipulated by that form, will it emerge the same. Its neck will be a little twisted, or, its back stretched out, for instance. Sometimes the particular essay seems to take to the form like a duck to water. And if I feel that it does, I'll leave it in there and just allow that step to kind of be the final essay as it is. And that's kind of what happened in the end notes for the Sheboygan Bratwurst, for the Wisconsin essay, and the New Jersey Ripper, which is a deep fried hot dog, for the New Jersey essay. Yeah.
Well, I think since we've gotten a little bit into process and how this book emerged from what must have been, various seances to get all of those dead animals to speak, There are a lot of food bloggers out there, a lot of food writers, despite the fact that the market seems to be saturated, you know, yet another food book. I still have young writers coming up to me and asking me about how one gets into food writing and things like that. And there's this archetypical problem in most food writing. One, I think you've shown us how you answered again and again, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it, right? And the big problem with food writing is, I am eating this thing and describing it, and you, reader, are not. It's right. My fun, right? So how do you help a younger writer start to think about moving outside of that I am reporting an event, which so much food writing seems to be revolving around?
Well, I feel like there's so much more to food writing too than just like the description of having eaten something. I think we really need to kind of interrogate. I mean, if we're going for that essay, like I am eating this and you are not, I think we have to interrogate our own responses to the thing that we're eating. If we find it delicious, why we find it delicious. If we find it grotesque, why we find it grotesque. And what that kind of claiming of ownership, just by ownership by adjective, delicious or grotesque, of a particular foodstuff means to, I guess, a larger culture at hand that also eats it and whose opinions may differ from ours and who are bringing their own memories and their own histories and their own economic backgrounds and racial backgrounds and regional backgrounds and things to the ways in which they eat this thing. And so that's a way to kind of get out of one's own head and start to think about taste as a communal sort of thing, and all of the different ways we taste things and why we taste things differently and what that means and what that can tell us about ourselves. I feel like, you know, just our reaction to the way something tastes isn't an end at all, but a springboard into perhaps a seemingly endless series of questions about identity and claiming ownership and violence and love and, of course, family and memory and ceremony, you know, the usual stuff. And but all of those things are ripe for further interrogation. The thing is, it's delicious. And I want to convince a reader that this is also delicious, but so what? There's more to the food than that. And there's more to the act of eating and tasting than that. And there's more to actually wanting to entreat a reader to love what you love or dislike what you dislike than that. And I feel like we have to ask ourselves those questions.
And I think your book is the happy manifestation of that kind of deeper thinking. And before it seems as though it is a book full of literary pleasures, which it is, I just want to remind listeners that there are 50 recipes. You can take this book and you can make things and eat things out of it. And I'm wondering if there's a particular recipe in it that you go back to or that still kind of haunts you as muse.
I was debating with my editor about whether or not the recipe should be in there, because I mean sometimes they really serve as odd juxtapositions in essays that are not necessarily about trying to make somebody desire this food and, you know, and to be hungry necessarily for Boston cream pie after, you know, either we have an essay about the Salem witch trials and various forms of punishment that were exacted on these poor women in New England. I guess they're in there. So in a way, I think it's sort of just an extra way in which the reader can interact with the book. I do want to invite the reader to have a conversation with the book, to argue with the book. You know, I mean, my desire when writing the book wasn't to confirm readerly expectation, but to agitate it. That's what I turn to art for, I guess, whether it's, you know, a book or a painting or something like that. I want to be agitated out of maybe, you know, a sense of complacency that I didn't even realize was a sense of complacency. And I feel like the recipes are maybe kind of a fun, guilty pleasure-ish sort of guilty pleasurable sort of way to interact with the book differently, and kind of extend the story. Here you are, you know, kind of going through all of these weird histories as they attend these particular foods. And now you get to make it in your kitchen and situate it within that particular context and maybe eat it with a heavier heart. That would excite me. I don't know if any of the dishes are really haunting me, but the one that I've been having, I'm glad you brought this up. It's relevant because I read the hot dish essay, or a portion of the hot dish essay is, I love making the hot dish recipe. It was contributed by a restaurant in Minneapolis called The Bulldog. And it's fun to see how in Minneapolis these days, folks are taking hot dish, which basically has, as you know, I mentioned and read about, very, very humble origins, and turning it into something gourmet. There's actually a restaurant in Minneapolis called Haute Dish, H-A-U-T-E dish, where they do this General Chow's sweetbread hot dish that is just out of this world. I love how, you know, these chefs are kind of interrogating the parameters of hot dish itself and what can it do. And so I've made this recipe and it's delicious. Instead of the standard canned cream of mushroom soup, they make this beautiful roasted mushroom bechamel sauce with all sorts of like wild mushrooms, some of which are foraged right there in the woods of Minnesota. Morels and chanterelle mushrooms. They use cremini mushrooms too. The meat in it is a braised beef brisket, but they actually braise it with this chocolate stout beer and red wine and brown sugar and all sorts of spices. Caramelized truffled Brussels sprouts are involved, and of course, house-made tater tots. It's not hot dish without the potato. so those show up in there too. So that kind of recipe excites me, and I guess haunts me, if only in that it served as muse via its interrogation of the parameters of something that was seen as standard.
Well, that might win over the foodie listeners who wouldn't have been as excited by Buttwitch.
you're talking about the halibut sandwich?
That's indeed what I'm talking about.
In Alaska, I lived in Alaska actually for 3.5 years. I ran a little breakfast joint, essentially a breakfast and lunch counter adjacent to a bowling alley there, and made, you know, your standard omelets. But one of the sides you could get with your omelet was reindeer sausage, and the blueberries that went into the blueberry pancakes. The other staff members and I would actually cull those blueberries from the mountains behind the restaurant. For lunch, we served a Buttwitch. The place was called the Channel Bowl Cafe. It is now sadly defunct, but the Channel Bowl, the bowling alley, is still there. And there's a bar there where you could see some of Juneau, Alaska's more famous alcoholics. But we served a lot of halibut sandwiches there. And so, which we called the Buttwitch. It's known colloquially in Alaska as the Buttwitch. And I was interested in how we have just kind of made this goofy sort of name out of this sandwich created from this majestic kind of diaphanous, curtain-like, gigantic fish. Fish that are so gigantic that oftentimes when long-line fishermen pull them up, I mean, they of course dwarf the size of the boat. And these fishermen would oftentimes tell these tales of emptying their shotguns into these flapping halibut. So just to like injure them before reloading and emptying the shotguns a second time into the halibut in order to kill it. And if they didn't do that, the flapping of this giant fish would be so violent. These crews would have been swept overboard and the boats would have been destroyed. And we just kind of, I don't know, cut a little piece of it, throw it on a bun, call it a Buttwitch, and then stop thinking about it. But, Yeah, I was interested in kind of that commingling of goofiness and majesty in yes. that essay.
The halibut epic, the first epic on halibut. Well, just to let listeners know, I mean, I think by the end of this interview, you come across as a food writer, and indeed, you've written a wonderful memoir on one of the great wines of the world. But you've also written on pot farms and giant squid, and so I'm just curious as to where you're going next in your work. Is there more dishes out there that you're thinking about taking up, or is a new subject looming on the horizon?
I think eventually I'll go back to food writing, but I think from my next project, this is going to be so horrible, but I'm going to say it. It's going to be a palate cleanser of sorts. And so, yeah, I think I need to take a break in between food writing projects. And I just really started to draft a new book-length essay on the carrier pigeon, and especially its role in South African and Namibian diamond smuggling. It still plays a very large role in the diamond smuggling, trade or illicit diamond trade in northern South Africa and southern Namibia. And it's a mess right now, Eric. But I'm envisioning it as this bumping and grinding of blood diamonds and the Autobahn field guide or something.
Well, I hope that when you finish it, you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I hope you have me. Thanks so much, Eric.
Matthew Frank, thanks for being on the New Books Network.
It was my pleasure.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Matthew Gavin Frank, author of The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food, on the New Books Network.